We'll resume our CMAC meeting with a discussion on disclosures related to IBOR reform. And am I passing over to Lyra?
Lyra,
Yes.
Over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Hello, CMAC members. Thank you very much for taking time to talk to us about IBOR reform. Now, this is a timely discussion because the topic we will be discussing today will form part of an exposure draft that we expect to be published soon. Because this is the first time that we talked to CMAC members about IBOR reform project, in our slide pack, in slide 2 and 3, we give some context about the reform itself and the project that the board undertook. So on slide 2, I don't want to go into too much detail, but want to just say that IBOR reform in itself is a regulatory-driven reform. In 2014, the Financial Stability Board recommended the reform of some major interest rate benchmarks. And since then, public authorities in many jurisdictions have taken steps to progress in effecting the reform. So in moving away from the existing benchmarks to benchmarks that are based on actual transactions that are nearly risk-free rates. We refer to them as alternative benchmark rates or RFRs. So there's no universal date as to when the IBOR reform is meant to be completed by, but there's a general expectation in the market that by end of 2021, some major interest rate benchmarks will cease to be published. And hence, by that time, the financial products that reference those benchmarks would have to be replaced with risk-free rates. The IBOR reform led to gave rise to accounting issues in slide number 3. We note that the board identified two groups of accounting issues and dealt with those in two separate phases. Phase one was looking at the issues that we refer as pre-replacement issues, so those issues that affect financial reporting before an entity replaces the benchmarks with RFRs. Phase one was completed in September 2019. We in appendix one of the pack, we provide an overview of what phase one amendments were about, including the disclosures that were added as a result of those amendments. So phase one amendments were issued in September 2019, and they became effective as of January 2020. As soon as phase one was completed, the board started discussing phase two issues. So this is the group of accounting issues that deals with those issues that affect financial reporting when an entity is actually replacing the benchmark from an IBOR to an RFR. In terms of discussions for phase two, the board started doing those discussions in September, October time last year. It completed its discussions just last month in February. And if everything goes as planned, we expect to issue an exposure draft by April. So that's the background. In terms of the session today, as I said, the given the upcoming exposure draft, we thought it's a good time for us to hear about your initial thoughts on the disclosure proposals that we included in this slide pack, and that will be also part of the upcoming exposure draft. In the slide pack, we also give an overview of the proposals on areas other than disclosures, so more specifically proposals on modification of financial assets, financial liabilities, and lease liabilities. So that's and then secondly, section number 2 is around proposals on some specific hedge accounting requirements. before moving on and into proposals for disclosures, and then the time for questions, which are set out in slide 19. So I'll move to slide number 8, which gives an overview of the proposals on modification of financial instruments. So now this is the area that stakeholders continuously raised with the board as an issue that the board will need to address in phase two, because in order for an entity to affect the reform, in most cases it will have to modify its financial instruments in order to replace the existing benchmark with an RFR. Applying the existing requirements in IFRS 9, every time there is a modification of a financial asset or financial liability, the entity will have to assess whether that modification leads to a derecognition of a financial instrument, and if not a derecognition, that it will have to calculate a gain or loss and recognize at the modification date. And this is an individual assessment for each modification. Now, this works well in a normal situation, but think about in a context of an IBOR reform, as we understand it, the replacement might happen in a large volume of financial instruments. For instance, if we think about a bank that has a large portfolio of variable interest rate loans and is replacing the IBORs that those loans refer to with RFRs, doing this assessment that we talked about individually for each modification would not always be feasible from the practical point of view. But also, as we set out in slide number 8, from the accounting point of view, the information resulting from that accounting would not always be particularly useful. So to address this point, the board decided to provide a practical expedient so that entities apply that as a practical expedient, as I said, to changes required by IBOR reform. And I will come back to what we mean with changes required by IBOR reform. So this practical expedient essentially means that entities will account by simply updating the effective interest rate from an IBOR to now reflect an RFR, and this would not involve doing the assessment we talked earlier, and also it wouldn't involve recognizing any gain or loss at the date that the replacement occurs. What do we mean with changes required by IBOR reform that are included in the scope of this practical expedient? If we think about in a simple scenario replacing an IBOR with an RFR, we know that IBORs are term rates predominantly, whereas the risk-free rates are overnight rates. And so doing this replacement will mean that entities will have to add a fixed spread to the RFR to compensate for the basis difference between the term rate being IBOR and the overnight rate being RFR. So this is an example of those changes that would fit into the changes required by IBOR reform. The board, when developing these proposals, also came up with two conditions that changes required by IBOR reform will have to meet. Firstly, those changes will have to be a direct consequence of IBOR reform. In other words, there shouldn't be additional changes that weren't necessary in order to affect the reform. It should be part of the scope of these population that we're talking about. And secondly, the second condition is that this replacement from IBOR to an RFR, it would be done in a way that is economically equivalent. And by this, we mean simply that the overall interest rate, so if you think IBOR before the replacement, RFR plus a fixed spread after the replacement, as an overall interest rate, it should be similar before and after the replacement. So that's the economic equivalence notion. So for these changes required by IBOR reform, the entity would apply this practical expedient that the board is proposing to provide. For all other changes that would be required, for all other changes that an entity might make that wouldn't necessarily meet the conditions to be determined as changes required by IBOR reform, then the entity will apply the normal, the existing requirements in IFRS 9. A similar practical expedience was also provided for lease liabilities, so modification to lease liabilities required by the reform. So that's slides 8 and 9 for modifications. And in terms of hedge accounting, so slides 10 and 11, I won't go into much detail because the general theme is it follows on what we talked about. So essentially, if there are financial instruments that are designated in a hedging relationship, normally any changes to hedged risk or changes to benchmarks that those the hedged item or hedging instruments refers to would have resulted in a discontinuation of a hedging hedge accounting. In the context of IBOR reform, the board took the view that as long as those changes are required by IBOR reform and only for those, the entity would be able to reflect those changes in the hedge documentation without having to discontinue hedge accounting. So I'll pause here. Maybe also just add that in terms of hedge accounting, any requirement for other changes, but also requirements around measurement and reporting hedge ineffectiveness, those remain unchanged. So before moving to disclosures, I'll just pause here if to see if there's any clarification needed or questions.
So just really, from my perspective, just to summarise, the board's work in this area is really to ensure that financial reporting continues to reflect the underlying economics, and actually changes which relate solely to IBOR reform, which are done on an economically equivalent basis, don't get in the way and distort that financial reporting, because without these exemptions, many of those changes would be reflected in financial reporting and would, in some respects, then hide any changes in the underlying economics, which clearly is important. But just before we move on to disclosures, I'm cognizant of time. Are there any particular areas of clarification that CMAC members seek, either of those who are, so Philip and anyone else who's on, who's dialed in? Philip, over to you.
Just very quickly, Nick, clarify. Oh, I'm off. Yes, I'm unmuted. Just for clarification on leases, so nothing will change on the balance sheet or the income statement. It's just a matter of, it's more of a technicality of updating the interest rate in the lease. Is that correct?
Yes, that is.
Okay.
Okay.
Perfect. Okay. Thanks,
okay. Yes. So moving on to slide 13, then this is the factors that the board considered when developing the disclosure proposals. I won't go into these factors, but this was just for the completeness point of view. Then slide 14 just provides a basis as to how the board concluded that disclosures for phase two are actually needed in order to, because in absence, users of financial statements would not be provided with useful information about the effects of the reform on an entity's financial instruments and its risk management. We also talked to users, and the general feedback, as noted in slide 15, is that there's overall support for, we heard support for board's tentative decisions, but a desire to, given the focus of these proposals is around determining what is the population of changes required by reform, and only those, that population, there was a desire for to have information that explains how the entity went about and the processes it followed to determine what changes are required by the reform, so and hence to which it applied the practical expedient that the board is proposing to provide. Then moving on to slide 16, so that is the board's tentative decision for the objective and the information to be disclosed. This really is trying to enable users of financial statements to have information about firstly, the nature and extent of risks arising from IBOR reform, and how is the entity managing those risks? And secondly, the progress that the entity has made in transitioning to alternative benchmark rates. So slide 17 then just provides a bit of color into what information we would expect to be provided based on the proposals for the required disclosures. The board expects that the information resulting from these disclosures would be primarily qualitative in nature. If finalized as proposed, they will form part of the existing standard, so IFRS 7. So now, in particular, in the proposal that is set out in slide 16.C, entities will need to explain how the entity determined those changes required by the reform. So the sort of the to address that user concern that we talked earlier. So far, in response to that requirement, we've heard a concern as to how useful that information might be, simply because given this is a market-wide reform, there was a sense that it might, the assessment as to which changes are required by the reform might be similar from entity to entity, and in that case, whether that will be useful to users of financial statements. So I'll pause there and move to slide 19, which sets out the two questions we have for today for CMAC members. The first being whether you think the proposals for disclosures that are set out in slide 16 would provide useful information in the context of IBOR reform. And secondly, specifically to the point noted in the requirement in 16, in slide 16.C, whether you have any concerns or whether you share the concern that whether that requirement will result in useful information.
Thanks, Lyra. And just as a reminder, as was set up at the start of this session, that clearly we do have reform of IBOR going on, but it's happening at different times, at different paces, in different jurisdictions around the world. So certainly as a multinational will be exposed to many different jurisdictions, and this reform will be that the path, it won't be all happening at the same time. So perhaps now I could ask those who are on video to indicate whether they'd like to give some views on the proposed disclosures here, if anyone would like to raise their hand. Okay, and anyone on who's dialed in?
Jeremy, please.
Go ahead, Jeremy.
It's a short point following on from Philip. I just really have a question for the risks on the leasing, the incremental borrowing rate. Is it correct that if there's a full retrospective method, then that would be the incremental borrowing rate at the time in the past? So that should not change. It's only for the modified application that there's a potential risk. And just to understand, the risk is that if it's not economically equivalent, then the borrowing rate may increase for the entity.
Well, yes, if it wasn't economically equivalent, they'd need to reset the rate to reflect the new rate. But I guess the expectation would be that in most cases, people will be seeking really to maintain the status quo.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Marriott. I'm sorry. I think I was on mute earlier. I just wanted to flag that I would also like to speak. I'm not sure if you heard me.
We didn't, but please go ahead now, Marietta. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I think, you know, absolutely everything that you say and propose makes sense conceptually. My only concern is that the new benchmark will just be looked at as something that is economically equivalent to the old benchmark plus a spread, when maybe in reality the dynamics and economics of the new benchmark could actually be very different from the old one. And in particular, I just wanted to draw your attention to the fact that IBOR was actually considered quite unreliable precisely because it wasn't based on any actual transactions and therefore potentially liable to abuse. Now, obviously, you know, me being a pharmaceutical analyst, I'm really not able to judge how big an issue that's going to be in practice. But since anything to do with interest rates has really been counterintuitive and heavily manipulated and at the center of the global debt bottle that is really in the process of imploding, I'm just very nervous. So to your point earlier, Nick, I really think that it's very important for the IASB to do a lot of work on that subject and to, you know, pick some really great, you know, bank analysts or economists' brains on the likelihood that the new and the old contracts, you know, are truly equivalent in economic terms before actually allowing a bank to just make that assumption that it is equivalent. Thank you.
Thank you, Marietta. Any other views around the proposed disclosures that staff have outlined?
I hope silence is sort of quiet support. Because preparers are going to look at these and say, this was meant to be helping us, not adding to our burden. So it would be good to have a wave of hands that show that, you know, the general direction is something supported by CMAQ.
Silence gives consent, I would say that.
Yes, I think you can take this as quiet support, definitely. So.
Thank you.
I would agree.
Sorry.
Okay, so this seems to be that I'm not hearing any dissent amongst CMAQ members. So I think we've clearly heard voices of support in terms of the direction of the disclosure proposals that we've included in the paper here. So I think this is staff. Do the staff have any other further questions or areas of clarification that they'd like from CMAQ members?
No, I think this was quite useful, and it sort of captured what we were hoping to hear. So, you know, hopefully we get just as much support when we go out into the exposure draft with the proposals. I think the only thing I would maybe flag is that we are hoping that these disclosures, or the way we are framing them in the exposure draft, would be that the disclosures are required even when an entity has not yet started changing things. So, you know, if you have a sort of a lazy entity that hasn't started acting on the reform yet, part of the disclosures because we require them to report on what is the progress they are making and how much of the assets and liabilities are still referenced to a rate that will change, that it would be quite obvious from the disclosures that they maybe haven't been moving at the same pace that some of their peers have been moving, or that they might be ahead of the curve. So, you know, we're hoping that without making it a stick, that the disclosures would help to, you know, get entities to move and comply with the reform and not necessarily delay changing the instruments just because they don't have to provide any disclosure.
Thanks, Rihanna. I think that's very useful to know. And if we can encourage entities to provide disclosures in that manner, that would be helpful, I think, to users. So any further points for the team on IBOR reform? Rosemary, please.
I just have a question, and it's following up on Marietta's question on the, so you have IBOR and you're looking at the equivalent, the economic equivalent to the risk-free rate plus a fixed rate spread. So is that a hypothetical? I'm just trying to understand, is there a real change in the economical equivalent, or is it just sort of to be practically expedient?
That's based on our understanding of what the banks are doing. So our understanding is when the banks are sort of providing sort of guidance to their bankers when they're in negotiations with clients, they're thinking about parameters where if you used to be using a particular benchmark rate and you're moving to a new rate, their discussions should be on the basis that to keep the sort of base rate component flat before you think about the credit risk margin, there'll be some sort of standard adjustment that they'll be looking at, and we're trying to capture that effect. If that's all they're trying to do, to try and sort of keep it flat in terms of the pricing between what they had before and what they had now, that they would use that for the assessment. But to Marietta's point, this will be one of the key areas of judgment, and that's where we've been having some of the discussions with the banks to make sure that there's been some real thinking and logic that's gone behind making that assessment. So what we're obviously sort of focused on, and that was before we even got into this very difficult economic environment, is whether people will use the opportunity or be forced by their clients in order to renegotiate their contracts to adjust credit spreads as well. And we're trying to differentiate actual changes in credit spreads, which isn't just because of IBOR reform, from the basic stuff you have to do to sort of comply with the requirement to move away from these old style base rates. And that's what we're trying to differentiate.
Okay, thank you. That's great.
Thanks, Sue. Any further comments on IBOR? No, I think we're all done. Thank you very much, the team. That's great. Thank you.
Thank you,
everyone.
So I think we are we're a couple of minutes early, but I think do we have the team here? I think I can see the whole team here for management commentary. So welcome. And I can see Tom and Gary in terms of board advisors on the project.